You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 335. Aw, Harry and Meghan. Wait a minute. Maybe the royal family are an establishment opiate to keep the people down. Aw, man. It's a World Cup draw in Moscow. Will Russia 2018 end England's 52 years of hurt? Probably not. And United Masters, how Google plans to destroy record labels. What? We'll be having none of that here. It's all coming up after Imagine Dragons and Radioactive.
I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing in the chemicals.
Welcome to the new age, as a single, a huge hit all around the world in 2013, including number 12 in the UK and number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100. From their album Night Visions, Imagine Dragons and Radioactive. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 335. I'm Terence Stackham. Now, wait for this, Jules. Wait for this. You're going to like this. She's not radioactive, but she is active on the radio. It's Juliet Harris.
Thank you very much. Hello. I'm ready to do this podcast, not least because I've breakfasted on the chocolate from my chocolate advent calendar that Terence, after I teased him on a podcast the previous week, has kindly sent to me to the post. So I'm now on a par with Terence's nieces and nephews, which delights me, I must admit.
You're in a very elite group of three that I send.
Absolutely, I am delighted. The chocolate reindeer, the lint chocolate reindeer I had on my first day, looked suspiciously like a small rabbit with antlers printed on the wrapper, but nonetheless, it was lovely.
It was the thought that counted.
Yeah, and it was a nice thought. And who doesn't love a bit of chocolate at breakfast time? So thank you very much.
Jules, you've possibly noticed this. I don't know. I'm not actually a member of the royal family.
No, well, I mean, I was starting to have my doubts, I must admit.
Yeah, it's just one of those quirks, one of those misfortunes in life, but more or less come to terms with it.
Really some sort of oversight, one imagines.
Absolutely. One of the great advantages of not being in the royal family is the reassured feeling I have in the certain knowledge that were I to become engaged to be married, I would not have to conduct one of those toe-curling interviews with Michelle Hussain on the BBC. No blame to be attached to Mrs. Hussain or even the participants.
It's made the best of a bad job, frankly.
That's exactly it. It's the format and that excruciating way we have of conducting these things as if it's still 1947. William and Catherine had to undertake the same embarrassed, intrusive endeavour with ITV's Tom Bradby a few years ago. The same uncomfortable questions. How did he propose? Did he go down on one knee? William, Catherine and Harry, they all show that familiar British awkwardness. But at least Meghan Markle brought a very welcome Los Angeles-easy confidence, I felt. And as an actress, she's years of feeling more relaxed in that sort of environment. Harry looked like a man trying to escape from a straitjacket, I think. Although there were no moments as monumentally awkward as Prince Charles with Diana in 1981 when asked if he was in love, said, whatever in love is.
Oh.
That was terrible. But Jules, I'm wondering if you engage with these sofa interviews, as I'm also wondering if these younger members of the royal family are mere pawns as the establishment uses them as a smokescreen, an opiate to keep us all proud to be British in our place and thus not sparking up revolution in the streets.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? My views on the royal family have moved as time's gone on, actually. I was a virulent Republican when I was younger, and I'm a bit more relaxed about it all now, really. Maybe the opiate is working on me, I don't know. I mean, I have to say at the moment, with everything being in a total mess everywhere, Trump, Brexit, our political position here, you know, no one can get anywhere. Everything feels very on a thread at the moment. So in a way, it was actually nice to have some good news. A young couple are getting married and I wish them well, etc. It's also quite nice. You know, the royal family aren't going anywhere. People that want them to go anywhere, well, guess what? They're not. The public are I think the usual polling that you see is something along the lines of 68% in favour. They're not going to go anywhere particularly. I think the young generation of royals, I admire them because they're doing their best to further kind of slightly more unusual causes. So they're all very much sort of going along social justice lines. Harry and went on that podcast with Bryony Gordon, didn't he, and spoke very much about his mental health, which I really admire. And the fact that there is now going to be a mixed race person in the royal family is fabulous, I think. I think that's really good. So it's difficult, isn't it? Yes, it probably is a con to keep us all relaxed. Having said that, though, given how terrible everything else is at the moment, I'm sort of happy to take it, really, which is awful, and I am a class traitor.
Those interviews, whilst on the surface appearing as soft as a cloud made from lamb's wool, have such hidden dangers. You can actually sense every journalist from every media outlet all around the world aching for an indiscreet revelation when the most they get is the engagement proposal was launched by Harry over a home-cooked meal of roast chicken, which was a warm, cosy image for all to savour, unless, of course, you're the chicken, because it didn't have much say about its participation.
No, indeed. Oh, don't set the vegan lobby off, for God's sake.
Darnu and Klasno. It's Russian week at the parish council.
Indeed, yes. I can't think of any Russian, actually, at the moment. I tell you about my friend who... No. My friend has decided she's going to start... a pal on Twitter has decided she's going to start a business printing up baby grows with left-wing slogans on them. she's called her business or her undertaking Little Comrade, and another friend of mine has suggested in Soviet Russia, baby changes you. Which I think is quite good. Class Snuggle seems to be the most popular suggestion so far, which is quite sweet. I suggested the potty bureau, but apparently that's two of chiefs, so I don't think that's made the cut.
We're all about Russia and the World Cup draw right after Supergrass. St. Petersburg is Russia's second largest city, previously called Petrograd and Leningrad, and it changed its name back to St. Petersburg in tribute to the Oxford-based Brit pop group Supergrass and their single from 2005. And Mr. Putin said, "We have no choice but to rename the city following this delightful single reaching number 22 in the UK top 40.
We have nothing to lose but our Brit pop change." Yes, indeed. I did not know that. Thank you as ever for bringing the facts to this. I now understand why you did pick St. Petersburg by Supergrass. I thought it was good, but I thought it was a somewhat ersatz choice from their repertoire. So I've finally fallen in. So thank you very much, Terence, for that.
Yeah, it does seem quite remarkable that they changed their name. You know, just due to the Brit poppers Supergrass. But well, there we are. You can't argue with history.
Well, that's Britain's influence in the world. It's us. We've made Britain great again, Terence.
Yeah, that's it. We've got our country back. Jules, my father used to tell me a story, a vivid memory of his, of how he returned from the war, the Second World War, in 1945, and desperate to see some football after the horrors and deprivations he'd been in Egypt and what was then called Palestine. He turned up at Stamford Bridge on November the 13th, 1945, to watch his beloved Chelsea take on Dynamo Moscow in a friendly match. And it was a goodwill game arranged quite remarkably, really, just 10 weeks after the end of the World War Two.
That is slightly ridiculous.
It's a bit odd, isn't it? At the time, Stamford Bridge held about 75,000 people officially, but my father reckoned about twice that number at least were actually in the ground. And photos I found on Google this week support that, because you can see not only people clinging to the roofs of the stands, but actually also congregating right up to the touchline. Even some on the pitch. And, well, in fact, Moscow had a goal disallowed as it went in via a spectator.
Honestly, what a nanny state Britain has always been.
Exactly. The game ended as a 3-3 draw, and my father felt that was a convenient nobody wins, nobody loses face conclusion.
It seems a fair result.
Yes,
it, really?
He felt it may have been prearranged. But here we are, 72 years on, and next year the Football World Cup is to be held in Russia at a time when the world is arguably no safer a place than it was in 1945. Now, the draw took place on Friday afternoon, safely delivered by Gary Lineker to a worldwide audience.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? You know, he thought FIFA was terribly corrupt until they paid him to do their draw.
I know, he wriggled about this on Twitter. A number of people tackled him, and he did wriggle a bit. So
it was rather disappointing, I think.
It was a little bit. Now, in the draw, England have been pulled out of the hat with Belgium, Panama and Tunisia. So no problems there, Jules. Straight through to the round of 16, win three more games and we're in the final. Everything will be okay.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it could have been a heck of a lot worse, couldn't it, really? Mm. Although I am sure, you know, weren't we here a little while ago when we all said, "Oh, thank goodness we've got Iceland in our group"?
That I'd rather
would be really
fear
easy,
we did.
Yeah. Wouldn't it? Yes, I can't. Yeah, I look forward to us making excuses for a nil all draw with footballing giants Panama. I must admit, yes. I have no expectations of England anymore. I think it's best not to, frankly. But interesting, it'll be the World Cup. I'm interested. I do love a World Cup, even if it is in Russia. I'd be interested to see how various teams get on. I think it's a bad sign. I've got this article from the Guardian website that goes through all 32 teams. It's a very bad sign. There are bookies' odds at the end of each paragraph. I think it's a very bad sign if there aren't even odds on you, frankly. So my best wishes to Iran, Serbia and Iceland, who they cannot even... I mean, even Saudi Arabia have got odds of 1,000 to 1. Maybe they'll be this year's Iceland. I don't know. Be interesting to see how various teams get on. Actually, I think England could learn a lot from Portugal. In terms of expectations and unrealistic and realistic expectations, if you set your expectations realistically, then you aren't disappointed. So we've got a quote from the Portugal coach Fernando Santos, who says, "Brazil, Argentina, Spain, Germany and France are the favourites to win the World Cup." And then he adds, "Then we have other candidates who want to get as far as possible and win the tournament if possible. And Portugal are in this second group." Now, I like that. I like, you know, we'll do as well as we can. And if we win, great. But otherwise, that's just the best we possibly can. I read they've got odds of 20 to 1. The only problem is their defence is pretty old. They've got Pepe, who's 35 next summer. Fonte, who'll be 34. And Bruno Alves will be 36. But the thing that interests me here, let's not forget, Portugal won Euro 2016. Yes. And yet they're saying, we might do well, we might not. Who knows? We're goodish. And actually, hurrah for Portugal and their realistic expectations. I am a huge fan. Sorry for my phone going off. I'm a huge fan of that. In the meantime, Spain, once world conquerors, now seem to be sort of slightly struggling. I don't know. It seems weird to have a World Cup for the first time in what feels like a lifetime without Italy in it. That's very odd. Or Holland. Yeah. That is, or the Netherlands, however you want to you want to slice them. There are certain teams who I wish very well. Australia were the 31st team to qualify, and according to this, they worked harder than anyone else. They travelled. How far do you think Australia travelled to qualify for the World Cup, Terence?
2,500 miles.
250,000 kilometres.
Oh my God, that's like to the moon and back, isn't it?
Because they played Saudi Arabia, Bangladesh, Tajikistan, Iran, Japan, Malaysia, and Honduras. Because that's the way that world section is sorted. So respect to Australia, frankly. Although having said that, again, they are overly relying on Tim Cahill, who will be just a mere 38 this month.
Gosh.
So I wonder how well they will get on. So when England complain about, you know, when we all make excuses for England and what a terrible time they've had, let's not forget that, you know, We're not doing a Portugal and keeping our expectations realistic, or at least the press won't anyway. We haven't travelled a quarter of a million kilometres to qualify, and our defence isn't that old, frankly. So I don't know, and we haven't played in any war zones. Let's hope we can at least make it past Panama.
God, I know. I like you. I fear the worst. A boring draw in the first game, then a defeat perhaps in the second one, then we play Belgium and we've got to win it to get through.
Yes.
I can just see that terrible scenario. You know, usually at events like the World Cup draw, there's some sort of unplanned disaster. You remember Madonna at the Brits 2 years ago, and
cake
malfunction.
Yeah, she fell down
over.
The stairs,
yeah.
and as Stan Collymore notably said on Twitter at the time, fair play to Madonna, she didn't even appeal for the penalty.
Or La La Land being handed Best Movie Oscar earlier this year when it should have gone to Moonlight. But the World Cup draw, it went really, really smoothly. I watched it live. The early shots of the Kremlin and Red Square were really genuinely beautiful. The only peculiar note was struck by a series of women dressed like Lady Gaga on hallucinogenics, leading on former players to help with the draw. But the very first ball to be pulled out of the bowl on the live draw was accompanied by a rather elderly Russian bloke booting the Perspex stand, and that caused a kind of ripple of mirth. But that was it on the lols front, really. But back to the actual football, yeah, it will be strange not to have Italy there at
or
all.
Or Holland, but neither of them there is really
that's
odd,
right.
I think.
Both always brighten up any tournament. But what I was thinking, Jules, of course we know that as Ireland, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland didn't get through the qualifying rounds.
That's disappointing. I'm sorry about that.
Well, you see, all of their supporters will rally round and support England. I can already picture all those flags of St George being waved from the windows from Glasgow to the Highlands. I can see it. I'm sure of it.
That's always a good day. Oh, by the way, interesting stat. So Group F, which seems to be the nearest thing to a group of death, contains Germany, Mexico, Sweden and South Korea. Someone pointed out on Twitter the other day that Group F in the World Cup is the only group never to produce a winner.
Oh.
And Germany is in that group. So it'd be very interesting to see if Germany can buck the statistical trend.
Oh, that is a curiosity,
and
yeah.
Other alarming facts, which might reassure us as England supporters. Well, I say supporters, that's a loose definition, isn't it? But says here, the most amazing statistic about England is that they have not lost a qualifying match for any major competition since October 2009.
Yes, but then what happens when we get to the tournament
is
I would say to the author of that piece, yes.
So who can find the key to unlock England in a major tournament? Will it be Gareth Southgate? Who knows? He has moved out Wayne Rooney, in fairness, so let's see if they can do it.
I'm already looking forward to it, you know. I'm like a little boy on these things. I just can't wait until it starts.
Have
I just
got your
love
Panini
it.
Album yet?
Oh, I'll have it. I'll have the flag in the car. I'll have everything. I'll have everything. I'll just completely thrown myself into it. I can't wait.
I do this every year usually. I don't know if they do it. I think they do it for World Cups, not just the Euros. But they, I think it is Panini actually, do an online sticker album.
Oh, do they indeed?
They give you packets every day and you can open them and actually stick them on your screen in the book. And I have to be honest and say that I really enjoy doing that. So I'll send you the link and we can do one together and swap with each other. Wouldn't that be nice?
That'll be lovely. I'll watch every game. I mean, I'll be doing the thing of, you know, the curtains and the blinds drawn at, you know, for the 1:30 p.m. kickoffs and everything. I can't wait.
Absolutely. Also, Japan have my favourite font and lettering on the back of their shirts, so I wish them well.
All right. Well, all the best to Japan and their font.
250-1. Maybe they'll be this year's Iceland.
Yeah. How Google plan to revolutionise how music is delivered? Is it the end for record labels? That's next after Jamiroquai.
It's just faintly ridiculous in 2017 to be picking a record by Jamiroquai, but I'd subscribe to Apple Music, and the other day there was a party starters playlist that I was forwarded, and so some of them I didn't feel were party starters, and this was on that. And while I wouldn't necessarily play it to start a party, I rather liked it, and I thought, you know, it reminds me of being at secondary school or just starting secondary school and constantly listening to music on the radio on the bus there and back. And actually, I do think that that has unexpectedly stood the test of time, actually. Cosmic Girl by Jamiroquai.
I had a quick look. 25 UK top 40 singles in a row.
They were successful. They were big.
I know. He seems to be living a more quiet life these days. But in the late 90s, early 2000s, he was a sort of familiar face, or more likely his car was a more familiar thing.
Yes, he was very into fast, because he was a bit of a Met Bar person, wasn't he?
Yeah, always just see him around Marlow, bombing about. I think he lives just up the road in the Chilterns, bombing around Marlow in one of his sports cars, Denise Van Outen at his side. But yeah, more quiet these days. The route to success for musicians has been a familiar one through the decades, at least since, say, Elvis and the Beatles. Get a manager, make some demos, get signed to a record label. Now, in recent years, as we know, the actual making of music has never been easier. You can make recordings at home on your tablet or laptop for virtually nothing, and no longer need to hire out Abbey Road and spend hundreds of thousands making a record. Where many musicians who follow this new route come a bit unstuck is in the distribution. It's fine selling music at gigs or digitally through your website, but few musicians have the publicity networks and distribution processes of the major labels. So it's continued, really, that singers and bands have still sought to sign with major record labels and give up royalty points and percentages to do so, to get their music distributed. Now, rather quietly launched this month has been United Masters, funded to the tune of $70 million by Google's parent company Alphabet. And it'll work by asking musicians to pay what they call competitive rates to distribute their music, split the royalties, but crucially, the artist retains full rights to the master recordings. And then, and I think this is really the significant thing, is based on data of the sales, United Masters then builds a CRM tool, customer relationship management. So the artist can target merchandise, info for live gigs, more music and so on. Now, Jules, I'm still not sure about this, but you're in a band and you've had a chance to look into this new idea from United Masters. Is it a brave new dawn for musicians, or maybe is it a case of out of one frying pan only to jump into a different corporate fire?
Well, yes, quite. And I think corporate is exactly the right word here. So obviously, bands have known for a while, I think, that the income streams, you know, it's not the traditional model of, you know, you make all your money off of selling loads of records. That rather collapsed with the sort of onset of downloading. And I remember some nice people I knew that ran a record shop in Tunbridge Wells that went bust just before the vinyl revolution, actually, which is a real shame. In 2008, I think they went under. They moved online. They decided not to have the shop anymore. Yeah. I remember me saying, what do you think's done it? And the nice man behind the counter said something along the lines of, you know, it's mostly downloading. And, you know, he said, people say that lots, you know, that, you know, it's legal downloading. He said, yes, Apple is not helpful, but a lot of it is illegal downloading. And that is really, you know, that the extent to which it went on, you know, it's you know, that was not helpful, really. So, and so then bands ended up, you know, moving into the live circuit, because that's where you made your money. And we've talked previously on the podcast about the difficulties of live venues being knocked over for expensive housing. And, you know, then people wonder why it is the same bands that, why Coldplay are headlining Glastonbury for the 45th time or whatever. I mean, obviously I'm a Coldplay fan, but equally it would be nice to see some diversity. So then it used to be very much frowned upon if you put your music on an advert. And now bands have cottoned on to the fact that you know, having your music commercially licensable is actually a way of making some money. I've got a friend that runs a small record label, and he now uses his music. He's quite careful in what he does use it for. But, you know, we made a record together, and we made a deal and signed an agreement that we were going to use it for certain things and not for other things, but we might want to use it on some adverts or films, possibly. That's the thing. So now we're in this stage where it's a step beyond that, isn't it, really? Because when I initially read this and you said, oh, you know, it gives you the opportunity to put your music onto Spotify and YouTube, it's the Spotify rates, the royalty rates from Spotify are notoriously tiny. Mm. You know, Lady Gaga got £15 one year, didn't she, or something ridiculous for having had millions and millions and millions, something like, but something absurd for having millions of streams, which then makes you think, well, how are you going to make the money? And then you get into this kind of, oh, well, actually, you make your money from being able to flog stuff to people. And actually, that's not what I want to do. I want people to buy my music. I don't want, you know, to make money off the fact that by listening to my music, people have then gone and bought, you know, a new fridge or whatever, or you know, it's something very, very malign about this that I don't like very much. My interpretation of this is that the way you make the money is not off the music, but by allowing yourself to be an advertising window, and that is for other things that are not your music, and I don't like that at all. I don't think it's pleasant. Whether or not it will catch on, who knows? As bands become more desperate, it might, who knows? But I would say to any bands thinking about this, will this actually result in a bigger platform for your music? Or will it just be a way of using your music in an indirect way to make money? And is that what you want? And is that what you're comfortable with?
Yeah, I mean, like you, I began to have a few doubts about this. When I first saw the kind of headline and the first few, the paragraph or two, when I heard about this, I thought, well, this sounds really, really, you know, could be really good for musicians. But the more I looked into it, the more some doubts around it. I suppose the people behind Google and Alphabet are experienced enough in business not to put their money into a pig in a poke. But we can be sure, you know, they've probably undertaken a massive amount of research. But and obviously, one would applaud a service that gives the power and the rights back to musicians over a corporate greed. Mm. But also, do you know?
But is it though, Terence? Is it?
Well, that's the dilemma, isn't it? Because I'm not so sure about this advertising and the targeting customers thing. I think it's supposed to be, I can see where the doubts come in this, but I think it's supposed to be that if they like your music, then you can get in touch with them and say, well, would you like to buy a band T-shirt, or would you like to come to our live gigs, rather than selling, you know, some sort of fridges or as you said,
I can see it going that way though. It does. I mean, because we all know that, you know, that the only way to, we all know that Spotify and YouTube streaming does not make money, so that is not a thing.
The argument there though, Jules, is that it's the long tail, isn't it? It's not going to make you money like you get from a record company. You get your sales, you get everything in the first year and then it tails off, so you might get £10,000 in the first year as a small artist and then that's it. The idea between Spotify is that you get money, but over a long
yes, but it's
lifetime.
A very small amount of money, because Spotify is, you know, pays so poorly when it comes to people being streamed. And I mean, but having said that, you say, oh, it offers you the opportunity to get in touch with people and say, do you want a band T-shirt? You can do that at the moment. You can set up a band camp, you know, you can you can have, you know, mailing lists, you can have all sorts of things. It's, I don't know, it's I mean, anyone can put their music up on YouTube, you know, eventually you can put your music up on Spotify. It doesn't have enough benefit to me for me to think that there isn't a catch to it, which is going to come in the way I've ended up having to sort of literally sell out.
I think one of the saddest things in a more kind of artistic way is, and this has already affected me because I don't buy singles anymore, I'm a digital fellow, you know, but it will be ultimately the complete end of seeing those cool logos that, you know, meant such a lot.
Yes.
You know, the Apple, Beatles Apple label, Motown, Asylum, Atlantic, Parlophone.
Yes, there was absolutely
something intrinsically romantic, wasn't there, about the designs and logos of those.
Well, I have an Atlantic labels. I have an Atlantic label on the back of my cover, and actually whenever I'm DJing and the music that I play is mostly, you know, quite old, often the quickest way for me to find records when I'm trying to search them in a box under pressure is to look for the labels.
Of course, yeah, excellent point. Yeah. Well, I don't know, maybe those days are gone, maybe United Artists will be the independent future, but as you've heard, we've both got some doubts about the whole practice.
Yes.
If you're not recording with your band, Go Boadicea, this week, where might we find you, Jules?
Well, I'm about to sneeze, so you can find me sneezing in the next 10 seconds. Bless me. Well, so last night was the Saturday social.
Bless you.
We were recording this. Thank you, because we're recording this on a Sunday. So, so yes, I'm just looking at my diary for this week. We do have Indie Wonderland this coming Wednesday. So that's 8 until 10 p.m. 6th of December on barricaderadio.com. Indie, alt rock, and miscellaneous. And I do not have any live engagements this week, which I'm very relieved by, it has to be said.
Thanks to you for listening.
And yes, you.
Yeah, you, right there. And thanks to executive producer Rona. To play us out, Jules, a single released in December 2013.
Yes, that's as contemporary as I get, I'm afraid. But, yeah, I really like this artist. She's called Anna Calvi. When I worked in Tunbridge Wells a few years ago, the lovely chap I shared a room with was very keen on her debut album. It was produced by Rob Ellis, who of previous of PJ Harvey family. It is very PJ Harvey. She's been compared a lot. But I do think she's actually very talented in her own right. Her first album, which was just called Anna Calvi, was nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. It won the European Border Breakers Award. She's English originally. She was also nominated for British Breakthrough Act at the 2012 Brit Awards. Her second album, which this is taken from, was released in 2013 called One Breath, and she also got a Mercury nomination for this. Again, this popped up on something the other day, and I just really enjoyed it. I think she's got a great style about her and a great presence, and I do think this is fab. This is Anna Calvi, and this is Suddenly.
Oh, You have been listening to a DAC Media production.
And I suppose in love.
Of course.
Whatever in love means.